This is Marketplace Money for the week of January 8th, 2010. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, supporting financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide since 1937. Putnam, a world of investing.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is Marketplace Money. Well, it's barely the new year, but this week the kind souls at the Internal Revenue Service decided to get our minds thinking about tax time. Thanks, guys. All right, so if you're one of the people who pays someone else to do your taxes, listen up. The IRS estimates there are at least 1 million people in this country who do tax prep for a living. A big chunk of them are called unenrolled, meaning they don't have any official credentials. They're not required to get a license or even to be educated in tax law. And here's the kicker. If they make a mistake on your tax form, you are liable for it. Sound like a problem? Uncle Sam certainly thinks so, and some new rules are on the way, but not in time for this tax season. Rico Galliano reports.
Mickey Reedy is an enrolled tax agent. That means he's licensed to represent taxpayers during an IRS audit. So he's got lots of stories about clients who ended up in hot water thanks to unscrupulous tax preparers.
The worst one was a client that I had under audit. This woman had come to the United States from Sweden. She understood the tax circumstances, but not well. The return had been prepared by a supposed professional, although he did not sign the return, which was one big indicator to me that there was something wrong.
Some other big indicators? Well, there's the fact the preparer would only take payment in cash, and that he put Reedy's client down for $45,000 in entertainment write-offs.
I asked the client, I said, what, did you spend $45,000 on it? She says, I never spent $45,000, $450,000 maybe.
Reedy says the IRS opened a criminal investigation against this particular preparer, but now they're hoping to prevent rogues from getting into the tax biz in the first place by holding all preparers to new federal standards. IRS spokesman Rafael Tolino says some tax professionals are already regulated.
An enrolled agent or a CPA or a tax attorney adheres currently to rigorous standards in order to do what they're supposed to do in the eyes of the IRS. Unenrolled preparers don't have that at this point. In future years, beginning this year, they will.
The new rules, which roll out over the next 2 to 3 years, subject unenrolled preparers to 3 new requirements. First, they'll have to pass a standardized test. Then they'll have to register with the IRS. And third, they'll have to undergo continuing tax education.
They will need to keep themselves up to speed with the changes in tax law, with the changes in preparing returns, and will have to continue to do so in order to be a preparer.
The IRS is calling for 15 hours of tax law and ethics study per year. Enrolled agent Mickey Reedy says that's a good start, but
what I would like to see is a push towards a more stringent exam, more education. Personally, I get 100 hours a year. I feel I need that.
In any case, until the new rules kick in, the IRS says taxpayer beware. Avoid preparers who promise you a huge refund. Steer clear of the ones who base their fee on how much of a refund they can get you. And check your tax preparer's credentials, because the IRS isn't doing that for you. Yet. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace Money.
Anyone who thought, hoped, prayed that the housing mess was almost over got a splash of cold water this week. The National Association of Realtors said pending home sales dropped big time in November. But on the upside, if you are one of those folks hoping to buy in this depressed market, the paperwork just got a little easier, at least in theory. That tall stack you get at closing includes something called the Good Faith Estimate. And as of the first of the year, it should, I repeat, should be a little easier to understand the terms of your mortgage. Holden Lewis is here to talk us through some of the changes. He writes about all things mortgage and housing related at Bankrate.com. Welcome back.
Thank you.
I want to ask you first whether you've had the pleasure, shall we say, of the old good faith estimate. Are you a homeowner?
I've owned 2 homes and refinanced one of them, so I've seen the GFE, the good faith estimate, 3 times.
And was it as confusing to you as the rest of us?
It was confusing. And the third time, I'd already been writing about mortgages, had this mortgage beat for a couple of years, and it was still you know, it was really a head scratcher.
Yeah, well, I suppose that says it all. Well, let's go back a step and explain to folks what exactly this is. This is a document that you get when you are buying a home, and it's supposed to tell you all kinds of things about your mortgage, right?
That's almost right. It's a document you get when you get a mortgage. And so it's not only buying a home, but also refinancing. Uh-huh. And yes, it is a summary or an itemization of all the charges that you're going to have to pay associated with getting this loan, everything from the origination fee to the title insurance.
And it also has the terms of your mortgage, correct?
Yes, it has what your interest rate is, the amount you're borrowing. All that is on the GFE.
But the problem historically has been not only that it's confusing, but there has really been no template for this. Depending on what broker you used, what bank you used, the form could be completely different.
That's right. There was not a standardized good faith estimate form. A lot of people got a one-page document that was like an 11 by 14 with small print. It might be two or three or even four pages. It just depended upon who your lender was.
So what does this new three-page form from the Department of Housing and Urban Development, what does this do to make a difference?
The new GFE has a number of features, a number of goals, I guess you could say. One is to make the lender stick to its estimated fees. Another is to allow you, the borrower, to compare different loan offers from the same lender. For example, kind of a plain vanilla loan, or one where you pay points to get a lower interest rate, or one where you pay a higher interest rate and don't have to pay as many fees. And then another thing it allows you to do is to compare loan offers from different lenders. It has a worksheet built into it.
You mentioned that one of the differences is that once you get this good faith estimate, the bank is required to stick to that estimate. That, again, is a real difference because, I mean, I will tell you as a homeowner myself, the good faith estimate I received at the beginning of the process was hundreds of dollars different from what I got at the end.
This bait and switch problem was rampant. For 35 years, really. People are afraid to even apply for a loan, I think, or they were afraid to apply for a loan for fear that they would be bait and switched. It was kind of like buying a car. I mean, I don't know about you, but if the car buying experience weren't so horrible, I would have owned more cars in my life.
Good point.
The same with loans. People would refinance more often or buy houses more often if they didn't feel like, you know, they were putting their financial lives in their hands.
Well, I suppose this goes some ways toward making the process a little easier, but nothing's going to get rid of that 3-inch stack of papers, is it?
Absolutely not. In fact, of course, this probably makes that stack a little bit higher, but hopefully a little easier to understand.
Holden Lewis writes about mortgages and real estate for Bankrate.com. Thanks so much for helping us out today.
You're welcome.
Last year, thousands of people either went into foreclosure or got really close to it. And our next commentator had a front row seat to the carnage. Harriet Brackey is a columnist for the Florida Sun Sentinel.
Whenever I write about mortgage loan modifications, I feel like I'm a battlefront reporter. On one side of the field, hundreds of thousands of people in trouble. They want to renegotiate their mortgages to hold on to their homes. They're frustrated on their best days. On other days, they're furious. On the other side of the field are the nation's biggest banks, who are sort of coping with the crisis, but not really resolving it. Both sides take aim, and I have to sort it out for a story. The phone rings, and it's an elderly lady with cancer who can't get Bank of America to give her a break on her mortgage. Or it's a man who lost his job a year ago who says the bank won't consider him in danger of default, so it won't negotiate. People say they send in the papers 3 or 4 times, but the papers are lost. Talk to the banks, and the folks who work there say they're not having fun either. J.P. Morgan Chase made some 4 million phone calls to borrowers in 3 months, compared to 400,000 the year before. Wells Fargo says it reaches out to each customer 20 times or more to try to get them to fill out the papers. Many or most don't. So this isn't working. And I say that again and again. I need to move on to other battles, so here's my plan to end this one. Stop with the 22-page questionnaire that asks borrowers to submit their monthly budgets. If a borrower says he or she can't afford the monthly payment, the bank should have to respond within a certain time period with a counteroffer. Can't pay $1,000? What about $800 for a couple of years and then bump it up again later? Make it quick. I've heard of people spending months to even a year waiting for an answer. Make it transparent. If the bank thinks the borrower will never be able to afford this mortgage, the bank should say so, and then give the homeowner a time frame so they can try and sell the house or try to save the home some other way before reaching the point of foreclosure. But most of all, make it end. I, for one, have battle fatigue.
Harriet Brackey writes for the Florida Sun Sentinel. Your thoughts? Go to marketplace.org and click on Contact. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This was the first full week of the new year. By now, we've made our resolutions, and a good many of us have already broken them. Last week, we asked you to write in with your money goals for 2010. Listener Maria Burgess of Washington, D.C. says it's high time she gets her financial house in order.
So my financial resolutions, as silly as this may sound, is I don't know my credit score. So the first one is to find out my credit score. And then to do everything I can to improve it, including paying, making sure everything's paid on time, and then making sure that by the end of the year, my savings account has 3 months of living expenses in it. I'm always giving advice to my friends, and, you know, I read financial websites all the time, so I know what I should be doing. And I'm really good at telling them what they should do. This year, I've decided to actually take my own advice. Today, before I came into the studio, I set up a savings account so that way whatever I deposit into my checking, 5% is automatically funneled into my savings. I've gotten into 2 different grad school programs and deferred them because I'm just not comfortable taking on that amount of financial responsibility. And so if I can stick to this for a year, I'll feel comfortable taking on grad school.
Listen to Maria Burgess with her New Year's resolution. Sounds like good goals to me. We'll hear more of your goals later in the show, including that, you know, it's one thing to make a New Year's resolution to improve yourself. It can be quite another to bring your family into the fold.
I want them to feel like they're part of the decision making and it's just not always their parents telling them no.
Teaching the kids about cash. It's coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Another 85,000 jobs went down the tubes last month. That is worse than what most economists were expecting. And it means more people will be hitting the copy center for new resumes. If you are lucky enough to get a job interview, suffice it to say, it probably won't be like the ones of old. No fancy meals, maybe not even a hotel stay. In fact, it might involve nothing more than flipping the switch on your home office computer for a video interview. It saves the employer time and money, but also offers an opportunity for job seekers to bomb miserably. From the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman takes a test drive.
I landed my first reporting job 20 years ago by barging into the newsroom of a small New England paper and wheedling an on-the-spot interview with the editor. She liked my chutzpah, and I got the job. Today, that first interview might go something like this.
Pole to Pole Consulting, Peter Frerich speaking.
Hi, it's Mitchell Hartman here.
I should be able to see you.
Welcome to the virtual interview, where two people converse via the internet. If both have webcams on their computers, they can see each other while they talk. More and more employers are using Skype, iChat, and other video conferencing technologies to screen applicants for jobs like restaurant manager and sales associate. Only finalists get to be interviewed in person. In fields like technology and accounting, even that final interview might be done on screen. Often, candidates are asked to record a video presentation as well. Now, in my case, I'm not up for a job. I'm Skyping with Peter Frericks. He's a business consultant in Santiago, Chile, far enough away to give the technology a good test run.
If you were assessing me for a job, let's say you wanted to hire me to be in your consultancy, what would you think? Just looking into the room,
it looks like one of these kidnapping videos from the Middle East. Not probably ideal for interviewing a candidate.
The video is a bit herky-jerky, and the fluorescent lights make it look like I'm coming down with something. But however it looks to the interviewer, the experience can be decidedly unnerving for the interviewee.
They asked me to go to a Kinko's.
Peter Reynolds did one of these a few years back. He was in his late 50s and up for a dean's job at a big East Coast university. He now works for the Army as a senior scientist.
It felt almost like talking to a wall. The degree of eye contact and the degree of feeling presence and being able to gauge reactions, the one-on-one experience, maybe it was just because it was new and something I hadn't ever done before, but it just felt bizarre.
You might think this is about age and familiarity with the technology. Well, Paul Snitker is 28. He's getting an MBA at Washington University in St. Louis. Virtual encounters are no big deal for him. He uses Skype to video chat with friends and family all the time.
I would still personally rather do face-to-face interviews. I find that you can get a better feel for the interviewer, for the culture at the company.
But Snitker may not have that option this spring when he applies for jobs, and so his university career office provides coaching on how to conduct yourself on screen, especially if you do this at home.
I would have to make sure I have a note up to the doorbell to tell nobody to ring the doorbell for the next half an hour that I'm in a meeting. And maybe even more so, you want to look at what's behind you, and you're going to give the interviewer, where you guys would have normally been on a neutral location, they can see a lot more about you as a person from what's behind you in the screen.
So here's some advice on backdrops. Bookcases, a classic art print, maybe a plant, all good. Desk clutter, beer fest poster, bright lights behind your head, all bad. Better yet, reduce your risk. Do this in a video conference or career center if one's available. Businessman Bobby Fitzgerald has just published an online guide to video interviewing. He runs a chain of upscale Italian restaurants out of Scottsdale, Arizona.
Put yourself in the mindset that you are walking into the corporate office of the company you are applying with. So the faux pas are little, but they add up. Dressing professionally, you know, recognizing that one should dress as they would be walking into a professional environment, not as they are in their own home.
And dress completely, says Judy Clark. She runs a human resources firm in Portland.
Make sure that you dress from head to toe, because frequently people are asked to step to a whiteboard and to write something out for the very purpose of being able to see whether or not they wore jeans underneath that suit coat.
Clark says the video interview can be difficult, especially for older workers who may find it informal and impersonal. She says resist that at all costs.
I'd say, yeah, I want to be able to demonstrate to you I can do it this way, because otherwise I may be labeled not as technologically forward, not as flexible, not as adaptable, not as suited for today's work environment.
One final piece of advice, practice, practice, practice. Download the video software, get a friend on screen, answer mock questions, try on different outfits, change the backdrop, and see what looks best. After all, you now get to choose the setting for your next big chance in this brave new webcam world. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace Money.
And for those who are curious about the details involved in this interview preparation, we've got a web-only interview on how to feng shui your background at our website. It's marketplace.org. Did I actually just say the phrase feng shui your background? We mentioned earlier that the housing recovery seems to be in a bit of a retreat, but at least that 3-inch stack of papers you sign at closing is going to get a little easier to understand. If only that were the case for the rest of the home buying process. Alas, it is not. So this week we're taking some of your questions about houses and mortgages and
everything those entail. And here with us once again is our good friend Nick Ritsinas of Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies. Hi, Nick.
Nice to be with you again.
What do you make of this week's news about the housing non-recovery? Pending sales not so hot in November. Was that just folks not wanting to spend the holidays looking for a house?
Well, part of it's seasonal, but part of it is we still have that nagging problem of foreclosures. And as long as that problem is with us, it's going to dampen any kind of housing recovery.
All right, our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. You can also send us an email through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And, Nick, you ready to take questions?
Absolutely.
All right, well, we've got one about the ever-present and ever-popular first-time homebuyer credit. Adrian is with us from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Adrian.
How's it going?
Very well. Are you a first-time homebuyer?
I am hoping to be so in a little less than a year.
All right. Well, that's very exciting, taking advantage of some of the lower housing prices there.
Yes. And the housing crash has brought things back into affordability ranges, it looks like.
Yeah. and so the first-time homebuyer credit has been extended, right, Nick?
Yes, it has, through the spring.
So what's your question, Adrian?
Well, I am planning on moving and therefore buying a home in the late summer, early fall time frame, which is, of course, after the tax credit expires.
Right.
However, depending on kind of how the timing works out, it could be worth buying early and getting the tax credit, and then that would effectively pay for the mortgage costs of letting the house sit for a couple months over the summer.
I do wonder, Adrian, whether the size of the credit, one, will be enough to cover the overlapping mortgage. And secondly, you know, part of it depends on what you think is going to happen to prices, whether you think the credit will be extended. So it's not immediately apparent to me that this is the obvious thing to do.
That's certainly true. I mean, I don't need the tax break at all.
You don't?
No.
Okay.
It's just one of those things where if I look at buying earlier versus buying later, it almost can come out in the wash. And if we're taking into consideration the Federal Reserve and the interest rate movements, that's about the only good reason that I can see to move it up.
Well, but let me tell you, Adrian, my first reaction to this is that when you have to get those pieces, all your ducks in a row in such a close proximity for this to work for you, you know, I just wonder if you're cutting it too close, if you haven't left yourself enough of a cushion, whichever way you decide to go.
I think you're right, not try to squeeze too many things on the head of a pin. But the issue, I think, Adrian, you might want to look at more closely is what's your expectation about how sensitive you are to a change of mortgage rates, how clear you are on where you want to live, and is it a possibility that prices might continue to decline in the areas you're looking at? Those, in some ways, are more fundamental questions than whether or not to squeeze it in to a calendar of a tax credit.
So what do you think, Adrian?
I think I'm probably going to wait.
All right. Thanks so much for the call.
Okay. Thank you.
Good luck with the home buying process.
Yes. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, let's go to our second caller. Mark is on the line from Brewerton, New York. And Mark, I understand you are a homeowner as well.
Yes, I am.
Tell us a little bit about your house.
I've owned it for 13 years. I refinanced to a 15-year fixed-rate mortgage about 8 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I also have a line of credit against it.
Oh, have you used that line of credit?
Yes, I have, for debt consolidation and home improvement.
And so what do you want to do now?
Since I'm going to continue to live here for a while and continue to make improvements, I'm wondering whether it would be worth my time and money to wrap the line of credit up along with the existing mortgage into a new mortgage and go to a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage.
And why do you feel like you want to do this?
I believe that I would probably end up with a lower payment. However, I don't know that that's necessarily in my best financial interest to do so.
Mm-hmm. So where do you see the benefit of getting a new mortgage?
It was basically just to try to consolidate my debt into one place and to free up money to work on the house.
Well, I don't know, Nick. I think this is a math problem.
No, it is. Certainly, the government, by allowing the deduction of mortgage interest, encourages this consolidation of debt using the home as collateral. Now, to do so, of course, we have to understand that includes some additional risk. But by putting it on the complete, put everything on the single mortgage, you're essentially sort of counting on your ability to continue to make your mortgage obligations. Because if you can't do that, you run the risk of losing your home.
Nick, you know, this is something that a lot of folks have done over the last several years, and I think we have traditionally been calling it using the home as an ATM. Is this a good idea?
Interestingly, Tess, 5 or 6 years ago, it was turned out to be an incredibly smart idea 5 or 6 years ago, because you'd take it out, and then you'd go to bed, and it's as if it was solar energy that were replenishing the equity.
Right.
Because home prices would go up. But now we found out there's a leak in that solar energy, and it doesn't always go in. Sometimes it goes out. So depending in part, Mark has to look at what kind of cushion he has. That is, how much equity he'll have, even if he adds on all this debt to his sort of first mortgage. If the cushion's significant, he can probably tolerate the risk. If it's not, then he's got to, I think, you know, look at this very, very closely before going forward.
Yeah. So okay. I guess the question is really whether you want to stick with the two various payments or roll it up. And, you know, I think there's some math involved. And as Nick said, you know, evaluating the risk for yourself.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for calling.
Okay.
Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can send an email through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And finally, Nick, we have a question about paying off a mortgage. I didn't know people still did this. Mortgage burning parties and the like. But Joyce is with us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and she's thinking about paying off someone else's mortgage. Hi, Joyce.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. You want to pay off mine or Nick's?
No, I don't care to do that.
Oh, shoot. Well, but, so whose mortgage are you thinking of paying off?
So I'm thinking of paying off my daughter's condo mortgage as a wedding gift.
Oh, how wonderful.
And that... I'd like it to be a surprise.
Nick, could she even do that without the daughter knowing, since the daughter is on the note?
Some lenders are not going to be willing, and most should not be willing to talk to you without your daughter's permission.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to be hard to keep this a secret. But it is certainly well-intentioned, so I don't want to discourage you from thinking about it. But I think this notion of keeping it a secret is going to be difficult, because I don't think you'll be able to get access to the right information without your daughter's knowledge.
How about the tax implications?
It is effectively gifting money. If you're reducing someone's outstanding indebtedness, whatever that reduction is constitutes a gift, and you'd be subject to all the IRS gift provisions.
And there are exclusions there, Joyce. I believe that you are allowed a $13,000 gift per year. And are you married?
Yes.
Then your husband would be allowed to do the $13,000 as well. So you could gift $26,000 to your daughter. And also you could gift it to her fiancé. So in total, you could give each of them $26,000 without any tax liability. I don't know whether that would cover the mortgage or not.
I believe it probably does. She happened to have bought a condo about 10 years ago, and it was a good deal when she bought it. So I think we're probably talking about the right price for knocking it off. But you're suggesting I have to then find out who her lender is.
Well, to get access to the information.
Right.
The lender's not going to just... Because think about it for a second. You wouldn't want the lender just to speak to anyone about your mortgage.
You would think any lender who's found someone who wants to pay a mortgage off these days would be more than willing to speak up. But so from your side of it, is it a good idea?
If you were my mom, I would love you to do this.
Yeah. From the perspective of your daughter, it is a wonderful idea.
Okay.
And I hope you get the big hug and the big thank you deserve.
Thank you very much.
All right. Okay. Have fun at the wedding.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, Nick, thanks so much for joining us. I was really hoping that Joyce was going to offer to pay off our mortgages, but I'm sorry, no dice.
You should have seen my fingers were crossed too, but unsuccessfully.
All right, our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or go to the Getting Personal link at our website. It's marketplace.org. And, you know, a lot of us are taking the new year to reevaluate our investments. So in a couple of weeks, we'll be taking your questions about stocks and bonds and pretty much everything market-related, so send those questions along. And, of course, check with your financial professional before making any big money decisions.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. And back to your financial resolutions for 2010. We've spent a lot of time on this show talking about kids and money. And what do you know? Some of you are listening. Tanya Brownlow of Minneapolis has vowed that this year she'll teach her kids what goes into managing the family finances. Here's her money goal for the new year.
My financial resolution for 2010 is to get my kids more involved in family financial decisions and get them to hopefully more understand how you stay out of debt and what it takes to keep you out of debt. I don't want my kids to end up in the situation that I and my partner are in right now. It puts a lot of stress on our family, and I just want to make sure that when they become adults, they don't fall into the same pitfalls we fell into. I want them to feel like they're part of the decision making, and it's just not always their parents telling them no. And also so they understand that you have choices with your money. You just sometimes have to make hard choices, and that's an okay thing in life. I think it's possible for us to stick to our resolutions. I think the first couple months are going to be really difficult, and if we can get past that, it's okay. But so far in the first week, we're doing pretty well.
Tanya Brownlow in Minneapolis. Later on, a personal finance pledge to pay the family first. Up next, if counting calories and cutting carbs helps you drop the pounds, maybe the same idea could work for dropping your debt.
At Weight Watchers, you set and track a daily goal for what you eat, and I lost all the weight. I thought, gosh, I bet that would work for money.
You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This week, one of the primary movers and shakers in legislation that affects our credit cards and bank accounts announced he will not run for re-election. Democratic Senator Christopher Dodd said there were myriad factors in his decision to end his congressional career, among them his recent battle with prostate cancer and anticipation of a tough re-election fight.
In the long sweep of American history, there are moments for each elected public official to step aside and let someone else step up.
Dodd currently serves as chairman of the Senate Banking Committee. Last spring, he helped push through the credit card reform bill. When we spoke with him about it in May, he indicated the work might not be done given the unilateral changes banks were continuing to make to credit card agreements.
We came very close to actually imposing a national usury cap, and I'm very close to endorsing one myself. The industry needs to wake up, step back, take a breath, and realize that what you've been doing here has been unfair. And frankly, there are other tools in our arsenal to deal with this industry if they decide they're going to punish the consumers because they finally stood up and demanding greater accountability, greater fairness.
Senator Dodd now has about 11 months to utilize that arsenal. Much as we'd like to think we've planned for life's contingencies, we really can't. But there's that whole turning lemons into lemonade idea to fall back on when things go sour. Alice Wood has her own lemonade stand, so to speak. It's called Wealth Watchers. And she's got a new book about a traumatic experience and the budgeting system that sprang from it. Alice, welcome to the show, and tell us a little bit about what happened.
Well, I was actually coming home from a ski trip with a friend of mine, and the aircraft we were on took off, and something went wrong. The airplane didn't pressurize. And when an airplane hits 10,000 feet, the oxygen masks automatically deploy. And that happened to us. And after a few minutes, the flight crew came through wearing portable tanks and masks. And, you know, it was just surreal. And you just thought, man, this is probably not really good. And I remember thinking, gosh, I think there's a good chance we're all going to die here. And I took the straps of my purse and wrapped them around my hand really tight so that my IDs would be with my body, which I'm sure is irrational. My body probably would have been everywhere. But
this is actually your training as you're an estate planner, right?
Right. We're always preparing people to die.
Right.
And then here I am facing that. And so probably that kicked in.
Well, so obviously there's a happy ending to this because we're speaking with you. But for the next several days, you started to experience some pretty severe issues.
I didn't really know something was wrong until I got home. And I kissed my husband, and then I realized my whole face was numb. Like every place the oxygen mask had been, it was like I'd had a shot of Novocaine. It was ultimately a hypoxic brain injury. I went too long without enough oxygen.
You went too long without enough oxygen. So what did that do to your brain?
Well, I think it's that the synapses weren't firing correctly, and I couldn't say my kids' names right. I couldn't do simple math. I had trouble driving. It was probably a little bit like drunk driving. I was just impaired.
Well, let's get to how this affected your finances. As you mentioned, you're an attorney. Tell us a little bit about your financial acuity prior to what happened.
Well, I grew up the daughter of a bank president, so everybody in our family was raised to be frugal. So when I, after the brain injury, tried to go on with my life, I realized that I'd become horrible with money. We started carrying a balance on our credit card. And that's not something we would have done. And when we were carrying a balance on our credit card, I told my husband, he mentioned, well, do you think we should get on a budget? And at the time, I kept thinking, this is like a cold. I'm going to get over it. This is just a short-term thing. It turns out that when you have a brain injury, it impacts your executive functioning. It's your ability to make good decisions. And mine was just lost.
At the same time, you talk in the book about the fact that you also not only started having different spending patterns, but you gained weight and you ultimately went to Weight Watchers. And this is where you had a bit of an epiphany.
I did. I still don't know what happened to my weight. I've always been pretty thin. So I don't know if I ate and I forgot I ate and I ate again, or if my metabolism was changed by the trauma. But at Weight Watchers, you set and track a daily goal for what you eat. And I lost all the weight. And I thought, gosh, I bet that would work for money.
I love the story that you tell about when you went to Weight Watchers and they wanted to acknowledge you for losing, I think it was 10 or 11 pounds. And you looked around the room and you thought, well, that's nothing compared to the people here who lost, like, you know, 100 pounds. Share with us what the group leader said there.
The group leader said, wouldn't it have been smart if all of us had come in when we only had 11 pounds to lose? And it's true, and it makes you think with money, wouldn't it be nice if people reached out for help before they get into too much trouble?
So with that as background, let's now turn to the Wealth Watchers program. The key here, as you mentioned, is the similarity to Weight Watchers, where it's daily journaling. What is your lesson here? What's different about your program?
Well, what we do and what I've never seen anybody else do is break it down to the day. And there is a daily number. I mean, you just have to calculate it. You have to figure out what are you bringing in, what are all of your expenses that you can't do anything about, and then what's left. That's your spending money. And to break that down, divide it by 30 or 31 days, and to have a daily goal, That was a big deal to me, and it's helped other people too.
Yeah, I guess that is different from just keeping track of what you're spending. You know, I think we're all familiar with, say, a monthly budget. But you're saying actually break that down into individual days so that on every single day you know what you have to spend?
That's right. Like, say, in our monthly budget, I have $3,000 roughly dollars of spending money a month. So that roughly breaks out to $100 a day. But when you start off day one of the month thinking you have $3,000 to spend, that seems like a lot.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is to get to the end of the month and not have spent more money than you made.
You're now 9 years past the incident with the airline. When you look back at this, is there any sense of a silver lining to something that so drastically altered your life?
Well, I can remember after this happened, I'd be laying in bed at night just wishing somebody would tell me I was terminal. I couldn't imagine going through the rest of my life living in this fog. And I thought I'd never say that anything good came out of it. It was just nothing but a horrible thing to go through. And now I'd have to say, you know, I think this is my purpose in life. I think I'm out here to say, you know what, this is really a simple idea. People should spend less money than they make, and that's how we should frame it, and that's what the goal should be. And it's just a simple message that I think we need to make it a popular, simple message.
Ellis Wood is the author of Wealth Watchers, a simple program to help you spend less and save more. And we'll have a link to her website on ours. It's marketplace.org. Ellis, it's been great talking to you. Thanks so much for sharing your story.
Thanks, Tess. Thanks for having me on your program.
And we'd like to hear how you're planning to save on daily costs this year. It's the question of the week at our website, which is marketplace.org. And now to our final listener resolution for the new year. Most of these promises aim to make a new and better you. And of course, here that means new and better money management. John Lucking of Montclair, New Jersey, has decided to put himself first when it comes to the long line of people trying to get their mitts on his money.
My financial resolution is pay ourselves first through automatic withdrawal from our checking account to one of three funds. One fund would be an emergency fund. Another one would be a short-term savings fund. And then another one would be what we call a stuff happens fund. So if the roof leaks or if we have a major car expense. What we're trying to do here is to take the amount out of our paycheck and assume what we have left is what we have for our budget. Our family at times had lived paycheck to paycheck, and we wanted to make savings for ourselves and for emergencies automatic. My wife and I have had this philosophy. It's just a matter of taking action. The New Year's, of course, is always a good time to discuss things and put things into motion and stick to them.
Our thanks to everyone who wrote in, and our resolution will be to check back in with today's contestants in a year to see how they did.
Marketplace Money is supported by LendingTree.com, offering the new loan coach, giving personalized financial advice for every step of the lending process. Just one of the many tools at the all-new LendingTree.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. And finally on the show today, a 20th birthday shout-out to one of the country's favorite financial disaster zones. This weekend, the Fox animated series ends its year-long celebration of two decades on the air. So we thought, why not check in on their economic well-being and money management skills? Or more accurately, their non-money management skills. I mean, listen to some of the things they've done. Homer got illegal cable. Bart needed money, so he sold his soul to Milhouse for $5. Homer spent Bart's acting money on what was supposed to go into the college fund. Wait, Bart has a college fund? Anyway, Lisa racked up a $1,200 bill on iTunes. Homer got in trouble with the IRS for claiming he had 9 kids. On a positive note, though, Marge bought a Chanel suit at a local discount store. Yay, Marge. Well, here with us to talk personal finance in Springfield is Chris Turner. He's the author of Planet Simpson. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So we got a glimpse of things to come from the very first episode of this show, right?
I think it's been pretty consistent all the way through. The Simpson family and Homer in particular have never been careful money managers. In fact, Homer himself has never seen a get-rich-quick scheme. He didn't try and back.
Well, let's talk about that first episode. Here, the family spends all the Christmas money to get rid of Bart's tattoo. I didn't know he had a tattoo. So Homer gets a second job as a Santa so they can buy some gifts. And then he gets his first paycheck. Let's play a clip.
Ah, son, one day you're going to know the satisfaction of payday, receiving a big fat check for a job well done.
Simpson, Homer, here you go.
Come on, son. Let's go cash this baby and get presents for... $13! Hey, wait a minute.
That's right, $120 gross. Less Social Security, less unemployment insurance,
but
less Santa training,
Santa
less
training.
Costume purchase,
wait
less
minute.
Beard rental, less Christmas
but,
club.
But,
see you next year.
Of course, he ultimately blew what little money he did have at the racetrack.
Right.
And voila, the Simpsons were born, right?
That's right. In fact, betting on the what became the family dog, Santa's Little Helper. I believe that's where the money went.
That's just sad. Now, Homer works at a nuclear power plant, as everybody knows, and Marge is a stay-at-home mom. What are their finances like?
Well, it's kind of a curious thing and you know, sort of unique to the Simpsons universe. Homer seems to be one of those rare, more or less working class guys who's still making enough money to support the whole family. And although they don't live particularly extravagantly in a lot, you know, they've got an old rundown car, TV still got rabbit ears on it, and it took them a long time to get a computer into the house. But they do actually seem to manage, and more than anything, seem to always have enough money on hand for Homer to basically, you know, eat and drink and otherwise consume as much as he possibly can and want to do. So they're kind of a mix there. Perhaps without ever actually stating it, they were part of the whole, you know, sort of 90s and early 21st century credit bubble.
Yeah, you know, sometimes it does seem to become almost absurdly close to reality. I remember the episode where Homer starts lusting after all the things his neighbor, Ned Flanders, has, like a satellite dish. So he tries to one-up him and go buy an RV.
Is that a good siren? Am I approved?
You ever known a siren to be good? No, Mr. Simpson, it's not. It's a bad siren. That's the computer in case I went blind telling me sell the vehicle to this fella and you're out of business.
And Chris, maybe the only thing that's not real is that he didn't get the RV, at least not till later in the episode, right?
Maybe it was just that's a fairly old episode, and maybe it was before that really easy credit started flowing through the system, because certainly, yeah, he would have got that loan 3-4 years ago effortlessly.
Right. You know, we laugh at The Simpsons, but really, they're just us on steroids, aren't they?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's really always been the show's strength, and a lot of, I think the reason why it's lasted and had the kind of resonance it had is because it is this sort of, you know, funhouse mirror reflection of what's going on. And if you look at a lot of the kind of excesses and pitfalls of the last 20 years, you'll see them in Homer Simpson's overconsumption, in his lack of planning for a rainy day, in, you know, his following of his desires to the detriment of those around him, and so on and so forth.
Well, as the show has tracked what's happened in the country economically over the last couple of decades, it certainly has done that over the last year, and one of my favorite recent episodes is where they realize they are in big trouble with their mortgage.
Let's see here, balloon payment, 37% interest compounded every minute, not understanding the contract fee, and here's your new monthly payment.
That number's so big it has a comma.
Oh, wait, I left out a zero.
Listen, you. When you gave me that money, you said I wouldn't have to repay it till the future. This isn't the future. It's the lousy stinking now.
I wonder if perhaps one of the great things about The Simpsons is that they can make us feel like, well, if they did it, maybe it's not so bad that we all did it, too.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's always been one of the sort of unique qualities of the show, is that as bumbling and irresponsible and in a lot of ways reprehensible as Homer Simpson can be, he's still ultimately a lovable old oaf and does, in fact, give us some comfort in our own excesses, maybe because they're at least a little bit less excessive than Homer's.
So there's at least one non-fan I remember from the early 90s when the show first started, and that was the first President Bush, George H.W., who basically told the country that they should be less like The Simpsons and more like The Waltons. Which financial model would you follow?
Well, I mean, if you look at the Simpson family's track record, and even more than that, the show's track record, it's probably been a more successful economic model than some of the ones that we tried back in the 80s and early 90s. And, you know, as Bart sort of said at the outset of that little controversy with George Bush Sr., he sort of said, you know, we're exactly like The Waltons. We're waiting for the Depression to end, too. And as it turns out, you know, The Simpsons outlasted that recession and enjoyed the boom, whereas President Bush was sent packing in that election. So I guess really maybe the Simpsons themselves provide the more robust economic model.
And they'll certainly be receiving residuals for years to come.
Definitely. It's definitely a cash cow.
Chris Turner is the author of the book Planet Simpson. Send us your favorite money lessons from The Simpsons. Go to our website. It's marketplace.org and click on Marketplace Money. Chris, thanks so much. It's been fun.
My pleasure.
As is our want here at Marketplace Money, we'd like to get personal and share some advice with America's favorite yellow four-fingered family. Get a financial advisor, or at least, you know, give us a call, because we know what you've been doing with those residuals. You told the world back in May of 2000 when you agreed to sit down for an episode of VH1's Behind the Laughter.
With Simpson merchandise selling like crazy and Simpson gin wetting whistles worldwide, the money was pouring in.
We were using $50 bills as toilet paper, and toilet paper as dog toilet paper. Don't!
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, want to be smarter about your portfolio? Why not try your hand at a better hand?
This is like your first decision. You've had an investment for a few months, now you get more information, and now you have to decide what you're going to do. See, that's just a nickel, so you know he doesn't have anything. Right?
If Wall Street's a casino, better learn a little Texas Hold'em. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman, Eve Tro, and Jolie Myers. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org. Or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering new ways for investors to pursue their goals with lower volatility on the web at putnam.com/absolute return.
American Public Media.